Jamie Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
What we are doing here tonight is protesting against the government wants to get all the power to itself and take all the rights from our citizens. And this is why we're here, fighting for our democracy.
A general strike has largely shut down Israel following a weekend of massive protests against Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to overhaul the judiciary and his firing of Israel's defense minister. As hundreds of thousands of Israelis call for preserving democracy in Israel, fewer demanding democratic rights for Palestinians. We'll go to Tel Aviv for the latest. Then, as the United Nations warned 2 billion people lack safe water, we'll look at the fight to protect water across the globe.
Water needs to be at the center of the global political agenda. All of humanity's hopes for the future depend in some way on charting a new science-based course to bring the water action agenda to life.
And we'll remember the human rights activist and lawyer Randall Robinson, the founder of TransAfrica, who's died at the age of 81. He played a critical role in the anti-apartheid movement in the United States. He was a prominent critic of U.S. policy in Haiti. In 2004, he helped expose the U.S. role in the coup that ousted Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
The problem is with our democracy. It wasn't ever with theirs. That we feel that we, by divine right, can go in and overthrow governments willy-nilly when they are living under leadership of their own clear choice.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Israel, hundreds of thousands of people poured into the streets over the weekend as the country's political crisis reached new heights. On Sunday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fired Defense Minister Yoav Gallant one day after Gallant called for a halt to the government's drastic judicial overhaul, which has triggered months of mass protests and international condemnation. Gallant said the plan posed a security threat after the military warned it may have to reduce operations as a growing number of reservists said they will refuse to show up for duty and protest. Israel's largest trade union is on a general strike today. Histadrut represents over 700,000 workers across various industries, including banks, healthcare, and transportation. New York's Israeli Consul General resigned in protest Sunday. In Tel Aviv, police used water cannons against protesters late Sunday as they blocked a multi-lane highway. Fires were set in at least 2 major roads. In Jerusalem, crowds also rallied outside Netanyahu's private residence.
I'm not sure. But we have no other choice but to fight. That's what we need to do.
Meanwhile, Israeli violence towards Palestinian continues. Israeli soldiers stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque in East Jerusalem over the weekend, forcibly removing Palestinian worshippers marking the holy month of Ramadan. On Sunday, Palestinian authorities said Israeli settlers burned down a home in a town northeast of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. President Biden declared a federal emergency after a devastating tornado killed at least 25 people in Mississippi and one in Alabama. Entire neighborhoods were flattened. Mississippi residents recounted the harrowing moment the storm hit their homes.
Going through my head. Lord, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't want me or the kids to die.
And ran, got in the bathroom, in the tub with my wife, and all threw pillows over us, and we could hear stuff hitting the roof, a lot of trees down.
While visiting the aftermath of the tornado, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas warned extreme weather events are increasing in gravity, in severity, and in frequency. Over 20 million people across the south and southeastern U.S. are under threat of more severe storms today. In Tunisia, the Coast Guard says it recovered the bodies of 10 migrants Sunday after their ship sank in the Mediterranean. The disaster came just hours after a human rights group said another 19 refugees from sub-Saharan Africa drowned off Tunisia's coast as they tried to cross to Italy to seek asylum. At least 67 migrants were reportedly missing. This comes as Italy's government says the number of migrants arriving at Italian ports has tripled in the first 3 months of 2023, with more than 4,000 people disembarking in southern Italy over the weekend. On Saturday, a humanitarian aid ship rescued 78 migrants aboard a sinking rubber dinghy in international waters near Malta. One day earlier, the rescue ship Geo Barents, operated by Doctors Without Borders, rescued 190 migrants, including unaccompanied minors, off the coast of Italy. Virginia Miel Gonzalez, a coordinator with the group, said a new set of rules passed by Italy's far-right government last month has severely curtailed rescue efforts in the Mediterranean.
Our main concern would be being detained, so being stopped from doing what we are doing. We are rescuing people in the Mediterranean Sea, which is something that it will still happen. The people will still use this route.
Ukraine called for an emergency meeting of the U.N. Security Council Sunday as NATO condemned Russia for its, quote, dangerous and irresponsible suggestion it could soon deploy tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus. President Vladimir Putin made the comments Saturday.
Alexander Lukashenko is right. He says, listen, we're your closest allies. Why do the Americans deploy their nuclear weapons to their allies on their territory, train the crews, pilots, how to use this type of weapon if needed? We agreed that we will do the same.
The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog, Rafael Grossi, is due to visit the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant this week amidst ongoing fears over a possible nuclear disaster. The plant has had to rely on its emergency diesel generator six times over the past year due to attacks in the region. On the battlefield, the Russian mercenary Wagner Group said it captured a metal plant in the north of Bakhmut. This comes after Ukraine said its military is still holding on to the decimated eastern city, which has been the site of some of the war's fiercest battles for months. In Afghanistan, at least six civilians were killed and several others wounded today in an explosion near the Afghan Foreign Ministry in Kabul. A police spokesperson said the blast occurred after guards shot a suicide bomber near a security checkpoint, leading to a heavily fortified street housing several government buildings. Honduras has formally cut ties with Taiwan while establishing diplomatic relations with China. In a statement issued Sunday, Honduras's foreign ministry called Taiwan an inalienable part of Chinese territory and said Beijing is the sole legitimate government there. Taiwan said it was closing its main embassy and a consulate in Honduras and is withdrawing its ambassador. The move leaves Taiwan with just 13 diplomatic partners, most of them in Central America, the Caribbean, and the South Pacific. Vice President Kamala Harris has begun a week-long tour of Africa during her first stop in Ghana. Harris said the Biden administration's committed to increasing economic investments across Africa. Harris will also visit Tanzania and Zambia as the U.S. seeks to counter Africa's growing ties with Russia and China. The government of Chad says it's nationalized all assets and rights held by ExxonMobil. The U.S. gas giant announced last year it sold its operations in Chad and Cameroon to UK-based Savannah Energy, which said it would contest Chad's nationalization plan. The West African nation has the 10th largest oil reserves in Africa and exports 90% of its oil. In Germany, transportation is at a standstill as workers nationwide hold a 24-hour mega strike. Union leaders say pay raises are a matter of survival for workers amid soaring inflation. It's the latest mass action led by unions in Europe as people struggle with mounting food and energy costs. Here in the U.S., educational staff in Los Angeles reached a tentative deal with the school district late Friday following a three-day strike. If approved, some 30,000 bus drivers, special education assistants, cafeteria workers, custodians, and others will receive a 30% wage increase, retroactive pay of up to $8,000, and average salaries of $33,000, up from $25,000. 35,000 L.A. public school teachers joined the picket line last week with the educational support workers. In other labor news, workers ousted the appointed president of the United Auto Workers in its first direct election by union members. Sean Fain, a three-decades-long union member, has vowed to take a tougher approach in contract negotiations. The UAW has been dogged by corruption scandals in recent years. Former President Donald Trump held his first major rally for his 2024 presidential campaign in Waco, Texas, Saturday, vowing to destroy the deep state, railing against prosecutors investigating his alleged crimes.
When they go after me, they're going after you. The only way to stop these arsonists is to rebuke and reject this evil persecution by sending us straight back to the White House to expel the communists and the Marxists and all of them in 2024.
Waco is currently marking the 30th anniversary of the federal siege of the Branch Davidians, an anti-government cult led by David Koresh, which ended in the deaths of 86 people. Waco has continued to hold symbolic value to right-wing extremists, including Timothy McVeigh, who said it inspired his deadly terror attack at a federal building in Oklahoma City exactly 2 years later in 1995. Timothy McVeigh was executed. Prior to the rally, Trump posted on his site Truth Social that filing charges against him could result in, quote, potential death and destruction. The Manhattan grand jury that could indict Trump is expected to resume its work today. Trump also posted a photo of himself holding a baseball bat next to a picture of Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. On Friday, Trump referred to Bragg, Manhattan's first black DA, as an animal. Also on Friday, Bragg's office received a letter containing a typewritten death threat and white powder. The Texas Observer says it's shutting down and will lay off its 17-person staff after 68 years of publication. The storied magazine was the longtime home of progressive journalists, including Ronnie Duggar, Molly Ivins, and Kay Northcott. The Observer is known for its combative style, its muckraking investigative journalism, for providing an independent voice in the face of mass media consolidation. In eastern Pennsylvania, at least 7 people are dead and 10 others hospitalized after an explosion leveled a chocolate factory in the town of West Reading. The blast destroyed one building and damaged another at the R.M. Palmer Company plant, known for producing seasonal chocolates, including Easter bunnies. Investigators have not yet determined the cause of the explosion. Philadelphia officials said Sunday tap water remains safe to drink until the end of today, following earlier warnings not to drink from the tap after a chemical processing plant released as much as 12,000 gallons of acrylic latex polymer into a tributary of the Delaware River. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney said late Sunday no contaminants had yet been found in the city's tap water system as authorities continue to conduct tests. The Guardian is reporting a police officer fired pepper ball rounds into the closed tent of slain activist Manuel Paez Teran before shooting at them with live fire, leading to their death. The activist, who went by the name Tortuguita, was killed while defending Georgia's Willani Forest from the construction of the $90 million police training facility dubbed Cop City. The new information surrounding Tortuguita's killing was recently revealed in police incident reports and confirms Atlanta police planned and led the deadly operation of January 18th. In financial news, First Citizens Bank announced it'll purchase a large portion of the assets of the failed Silicon Valley Bank. 17 former branches of SVB will now operate as First Citizens Banks. The FDIC took over SVB earlier this month after a run on the bank caused it to collapse in the second largest bank failure in U.S. history. And House Republicans passed a bill increasing parental control in public schools, including a right to review curricula and reading lists, as well as books that are available at school libraries. The so-called parental rights had become a flashpoint for conservatives and has led to over 1,600 books being banned in school libraries and classrooms from mid-2021 to 2022. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said the Democrat-controlled Senate will not take up the bill, which he called Orwellian to the core. Fellow New York lawmaker Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez spoke out against the measure Thursday on the House floor.
Look at these books that have already been banned due to Republican measures. The Life of Rosa Parks. This apparently is too woke by the Republican Party. Song of Solomon is unacceptable to Republican politics. 40% of banned books reported are significantly addressing and specifically addressing LGBT issues.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at the growing political crisis in Israel. Workers across Israel are taking part in a general strike today to protest plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to disempower Israel's judiciary. Critics say the moves could turn Israel into a dictatorship. The strike has shut down Israel's two main seaports. Flights have been suspended at Israel's Ben-Gurion Airport. The strike has also shut down schools, banks, and other institutions. Over the weekend, hundreds of thousands of Israelis took part in protests. Many blocked roads and highways, shutting down large parts of the country. On Sunday, Prime Minister Netanyahu fired his defense minister, Yoav Gallant, who had warned that plans to overhaul the judiciary posed a, quote, clear, immediate, and tangible threat to the security of the state. These are the voices of some of the protesters in Tel Aviv this weekend.
Soldiers from the Yom Kippur War. This is an emergency time for the democracy of Israel. And we all here to fight for the liberal democracy and our rights in the Jewish state, which was established 75 years ago. We all have to fight for our rights because of the plans of Benjamin Netanyahu that want to turn this nation into a dictatorship.
What we are doing here tonight is protesting against the government, wants to get all the power to itself and take all the rights from our citizens. And this is why we're here, fighting for our democracy.
As hundreds of thousands of Israelis call for preserving democracy in Israel, few are demanding democratic rights for all Palestinians in these protests. We go now to Tel Aviv, where we're joined by Haggai Mattar, executive director of Plus 972 magazine. Haggai, thank you so much for joining us. There's so much happening and so quickly changing in the streets right now of Israel. Talk about the significance of the mass protest and the firing, Netanyahu's firing of the defense minister.
Thank you, Amy, and thank you for having me. This is truly an unprecedented moment, and unprecedented is an understatement. We've never seen such a massive, powerful, committed protest movement in Israeli history. There's really been nothing even to compare it to. Right now, people are demonstrating throughout the country. People are blocking main roads and seaports and so on, with the unions just joining today. I think it's interesting to note, and not a coincidence, speaking of Palestinians, that the reason that kind of really pushed the unions to join, the universities and others, kind of the larger institutions to join the protest movement, is the firing of the defense minister, who said that the steps Netanyahu is taking is threatening Israel's defense. That is still kind of the rallying message for many Israelis for this protest movement. And while the chance are for democracy and for equality, it still feels like for many people it is an internal Jewish conversation. At the same time, I have to say it's incredible and very inspiring to see such a force of people coming out and trying to defend democracy, albeit limited and only for Jews, which is, of course, no democracy at all. But still, the power of it is truly incredible.
So Yoav Gallant, the Israeli defense minister who resigned, it's not as if he didn't support weakening the judiciary as Netanyahu is pushing it through, but explain what he objected to. Also, the consul general, the Israeli consul general here in New York, just resigned.
Yes, the Israeli consul general is liberal from the left. He's kind of a remnant from the previous government. And the fact that he stayed this long, it's surprising. But for Yoav Gallant, he's really a hawk. He's also a war criminal. He was the responsible general for the war crimes of the Cast-Lead operation in Gaza in 2009. He is no defender of democracy in any way. The only reason he decided to step up against Netanyahu was that the army is basically collapsing. The central and most important units that sustain Israel's Air Force and Intelligence Corps are basically filled with thousands of people who are saying that they will refuse to continue service or their reserve service if the legal overhaul goes through. So Gallant, as a former general and a defense minister, says, we cannot sustain Israel's defense without an army. The army is collapsing because of these reforms. It's not that I don't support them. We just don't have an army left. So that's where Gallant is coming from. And when Netanyahu's response is not, okay, I'm listening, but actually I'm going to fire you just because you disagree with me, that was kind of the last straw that pushed the unions and other major players into the game.
You say he should have been fired, but he was fired for the wrong reasons, Haggai.
The entire government should be fired, but, you know, it's there, and everybody there are playing some part in different kinds of war crimes. And he is being fired for the wrong reasons, yes.
So explain what's happening in the West Bank and Gaza right now. I mean, you have this unprecedented mass protest, Histadrut, the unions demanding change and the stopping of what's happening. But how has life changed in the West Bank and Gaza?
So Gaza has been very much the same, under the same siege for over 15 years now. Just the same situation, which actually means people's lives continuously deteriorating, but not in any very substantially different way now than they were 1, 2, or 5 years ago. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, we have seen Israel over the past year and a half escalating measures of annexation, of plans for ethnic cleansing, of attacks on Palestinians, which has led to more and more resistance on the side of Palestinians, with the Palestinian Authority basically losing control of entire parts of the West Bank and militants stepping up their attacks on Israelis. And that also has been ongoing since even the previous government and is ongoing and escalating these very days. I think Palestinians also in many ways are just looking at what's happening inside of Israel and waiting to see what plays out and where this is going. This government, which was seen as a stable far-right government with very dangerous plans for Palestinians, might collapse within a matter of days. So Palestinians now just started the holy month of Ramadan, always a very strenuous time, are basically looking to see where things are going at this moment.
I mean, the parallels with the United States between Netanyahu and Trump, both are under investigation. Netanyahu has been indicted for corruption. Trump is about, it looks like, to be indicted. And both trying to now completely going after the judiciary. In fact, if these judicial changes went through, wouldn't that also benefit Netanyahu personally?
Yes, of course. That is his own personal motivation. There's kind of a cluster of motivations for this attack on the judicial system and Netanyahu's personal and some other ministers' personal interests for their indictments for corruption are one element. The other elements are plans from the religious parties to promote a clerical agenda, a very extreme agenda of Jewish religion taking over the somewhat secular nature of the country, and plans for forced annexation and forced deportation of Palestinians. All these things are things that the judicial system, which has not been an ally to Palestinians in any way or a defender of human rights in any way, has put in place some checks and balances, and those are the checks and balances around corruption, religion, and annexation that they're trying to dismantle right now. The difference, by the way, between Israel and the U.S. is that Israel doesn't have a constitution and doesn't have any mechanisms to stop this from happening, except from the power of the people that are out in the streets.
And what would happen if the government did collapse? I mean, there every hour it's being said that Netanyahu is about to address the nation, though he hasn't.
We are hearing that Netanyahu is very likely in the coming few hours to actually announce a halt to the reforms. He understands that he cannot move forward, that the power against him is greater than he's ever seen before internally. So he will announce a halt, most likely. And then the question is, what happens next? Will he succeed to still takes charge of his government. His coalition is falling apart, with the far right saying, if you're stopping the reform, we're going to leave. So it's likely that the coalition will collapse. And then what comes next? The highest chances are for a new sort of coalition between the right and the center, in which they will kind of aim to create a government of healing, so-called, and try to offer some protections to the judicial system and stem the far right, but also protect the essential nature of the state as an apartheid state. That will be kind of off the table, off negotiations. I think there are, and the protest movement will accept that. The protest movement will accept that warmly. I think there are questions as to what degree will Palestinians accept that, and to what degree will international allies of Israel that have been very, very concerned with what's been happening, including international finance and big capital that has been pulling away money, divesting from the Israeli economy, to what degree will it be willing to reinvest, reengage with Israel without and get some process with Palestinians, without Israel adopting equality and an end to apartheid as a policy. If the international community accepts Israel under these conditions of yes to apartheid, no to the judicial reform, that will mean that the system will stay basically as is. We can only hope and demand that international players hold Israel to account also on apartheid and not only on the recent measures.
Hagai Matar, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Plus 972 Magazine, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. When we come back, a quarter of humanity lacks access to clean drinking water. We'll look at the fight to protect water across the globe. Stay with us. Every time I'm alone, I always get to thinking, I drive myself insane. Johnny Polonsky here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to a somewhat overlooked but hugely significant new report by the United Nations that warns a quarter of humanity lacks access to safe drinking water. Nearly half the global population has no access to basic sanitation. Unless action is taken, 60% of the world's population could face water supply issues by 2050. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres addressed the findings at the UN Water Conference here in New York last week, the first such event in nearly half a century.
Water is a human right and the common development denominator to shape a better future. But water is in deep trouble. We are draining humanity's lifeblood through vampiric overconsumption and unsustainable use, and evaporating it through global eating.
The Secretary General follows other UN Secretaries General who warned of the link between water and the potential for war, including Boutros Boutros-Ghali in 1985, who said, quote, the next war in the Middle East will be fought over water, not politics. And Ban Ki-moon, who warned in 2007, quote, water scarcity threatens economic and social gains and is a potent fuel for wars and conflict. For more, we're joined by two guests who work in areas facing some of the worst water scarcity. In Phoenix, Arizona, Mohammed Mahmoud is with us, director of the Climate and Water Program at the Middle East Institute. And in the capital of Nigeria, in Abuja, Buluwaji Onabolu is with us, president of the Network of Nigerian Female Professionals. in Nigeria in the diaspora, which focuses on water, sanitation, hygiene, and public health. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Obuluwaji. If you can talk about what's happening across the continent of Africa, the numbers are absolutely terrifying of who has access to water, to clean drinking water, not to mention sanitation.
Thank you very much, Amy, for having me on. Before I speak about Africa, the World Water Report that you referred to has actually brought to the attention of the world something that is a bit different from what we in the sector have been looking at. Usually, reports would say this number, this proportion of people globally will not have access to basic water and sanitation, for example.